Bob Murphy Show, episode 318.
There's a tidal wave coming. What you gonna do?
Get ready for another episode of The Bob Murphy Show, the podcast promoting free markets, free minds, and grateful souls. It's your source for commentary and interviews conducted by a Christian and economist. Now here's your host, Bob Murphy.
Hey everybody, welcome back to The Bob Murphy Show. Today we're going to be speaking with Tom Jenny, who's here to talk about his book project. Let me first just read a little bit of his bio, and then I'll talk about his book, Enterprise. Tom Jenny lives in Phoenix, Arizona. He was born in Tucson, where he graduated from University High School. He earned an associate degree from the New Mexico Military Institute and a bachelor's degree in Spanish and Latin American Studies from Georgetown. In Washington, D.C. and Phoenix, Jenny has worked as a think tanker, fundraiser, grassroots organizer, and lobbyist. He has taught government economics and Spanish to high schoolers, has served as a bookkeeper and treasurer for several nonprofit organizations. He's served as a deacon and elder at his church. He's happily married, and he's the adoring father of two children. So Tom has written an interesting book, and I will confess it piqued my interest because it does involve me, that there's at least one of the stories it's written in the second person, and we get into this in the discussion, but in one of them it's like talking to the reader and saying, and you're familiar with the work of Robert Murphy and da, 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 da. So here's the hook that I'll read. And then, as I say, obviously in the show, we'll get more into what's going on here. But if this intrigues you, what if you woke up one morning and almost everybody in America agreed with you about politics? What if America's government suddenly started enacting the policies you want? Things would turn out great, right? Or would they? Or would they was from me. All right. So I will not spoil it. The project is called American Futures. It's a very lengthy, detailed project, but why don't we just jump right into it? Here's my conversation with Tom Jenny. Tom, welcome to the Bob Murphy Show.
Hi, Bob. I'm glad I'm here.
Well, you're here to explain your large-scale book project. So how do you want to – maybe before you dive into that, just maybe give a little bit of background about who you are and what led you into this endeavor.
All right. I'm about 53 years old and I live in Phoenix, Arizona, and I work in a library in a castle in downtown Phoenix. It's an Irish castle. So with that last name of yours, you're welcome in there. So it's a fascinating job, but that's my day job. And I write on the side. And I've recently published
I got to stop you on a castle. So what do you mean? Like people are driving around town, they look up and it legit looks like a castle?
Yeah, it's a three-story replica of a Norman castle from Clare County in Ireland. So, and we'll let anybody in, but if your last name's Murphy, we'll be extra nice to you.
Okay, well, that's good. Yeah, it's pertinent to the libertarian immigration debate, whether they can exclude people from entering the library. So that's good to know.
Yeah.
Okay. So are you a librarian? Is that your title?
No. Okay. I'm more of a finance and fundraising kind of guy.
So okay.
More of a vision guy and trying to bring in some money for the place and make it run better and all that. So, but no, we've got librarians on
the
staff.
The installation on those castles is atrocious, is my understanding.
Yeah. Inside, it's a modern library. It's a fully modern library, and we do our gateway drug is genealogy. So people will, say to themselves, "Hey, I want to go to Ireland finally," and then they come and visit us and use our databases and use our staff support to try to figure out where their people came from, and so that when they go back to the home country, they can they'll know where to go.
Okay.
Anyway, that's my day job. But I spent a long time in the free market policy world. So way back in 1994, I was working at the Cato Institute with people like Sheldon Richman, who you had on this podcast a few weeks ago. Worked with Sheldon and a lot of people from back in that day. And I moved back to Arizona in 2002. I'm from Arizona, and I moved back to Arizona about 2002 and worked with the Goldwater Institute. And then I got a gig for 12 years. I was the state director of Americans for Prosperity.
Okay.
So driving around the state and stirring stuff up and throwing tea parties and all that. So,
can we just go back even earlier then? Just, I'm curious, how did you get into all this stuff? Because even in 94, you were an adult at that point, right?
I mean, according to the age, yeah.
but not at heart?
Yeah, whether I behaved as an adult is a different question.
The Cato Institute, hanging out with Sheldon Richman, you guys are probably nullifying things left and right.
Yeah, but, yeah. So how did I get into this? My dad was, still is, kind of a Barry Goldwater Republican. Mm-hmm. He read National Review every week for, the whole time I was a kid. And, he'd always ask me whenever I came home from school, he'd say, "What did the Pinko social studies teacher say today?" And he'd provide a different perspective. So I really got it. I probably got it from my parents. And like you, when you were talking to Kinsella, I think the other day, you said that you really didn't, it didn't begin with Ayn Rand, Chile's book, it usually starts with Ayn Rand. It really did not for me. I've read Rand and, I've enjoyed it, but, that's not really where I came from. I didn't come out of the objectivist world. And like you, I'm a Christian and I've got a lot of sympathy for altruism. So, or at least Christian charity. So, mm-hmm. I think we're maybe on similar wavelengths that way. And I'm also a convert late in life. Someday we can talk about that maybe offline, but I feel like I'm sort of from a similar background, except I don't know nearly as much about Austrian economics as you do. I taught high school economics for a year here in Phoenix, and between policy type jobs. So,
Castles. So,
oh, that's true. Well, I used Gene Callahan's book Economics for Real People. That was the real text for the high school economics, and then use the econ textbook, the high school econ textbook, as kind of a foil.
Right.
Okay, they just said this, but now that you're starting to understand what's really going on in economics, what do you think of that statement? And having people kind of use that as a way to explain economics better. And I think high school kids like that. If they can hear you say, "Yeah, this textbook is kind of crap." I think they sort of enjoy that. This textbook that the state of Arizona wants you to read is not where it's at. So when you start digging in to some of my philosophical, ideological, economic propositions, you'll find I'm only about 95% on anything. That's kind of one of my mantras lately is 95% is pretty good. It's an A.
What do you mean by that?
I just meant like if you say, okay, so you're a whole hog Austrian economist.
Oh, I got you.
Austrian economics. And I'll probably say, and then there's all kinds of, I've read Brian Kaplan's essay on why he was not an Austrian.
Right.
I still think I'm mostly Austrian.
Okay. But, do you only follow 9 of the commandments?
Probably, yeah.
Okay.
Or any given day, for sure.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm struggling, And then, there's always the deep question of why don't we follow all 613, a lot of modern Christians tend to stop at the 10 and we're good with that. And my Orthodox Jewish friends ask, hey, what happened to the others?
Yeah. So, your book project, I know you had pointed to it before we started recording. Is it worth showing people physically what we're talking about?
Yeah, I'm doing this backwards. So let's see. Yeah, that thing. So if you happen to want to publish the giant doorstops that are the three volumes, there's 60 stories collected, and I finally had to chop them into three volumes. I went with a formatting company that Tom Woods recommended in some of his videos. And it took a long time to format this thing into something that was printable. And so if you get the Kindle, all of it's in one Kindle book. But if you get the paperbacks, it's split into three volumes. So it's massive. And a lot of people buy it and then they say, oh my God, Don, this is insane.
And it's the project is called the American Futures?
Yeah, that's what I ended up calling the collection because it's a futurology kind of a thing. So it to a large extent. And did you want me to kind of lay out for people how the thing works? Would this be a good time
Maybe first, let me just ask you this. So it's a collection of stories. That's a true statement, right?
Yep.
And did you first just start writing random stories and then thought I'm going to collect them? Or did you know from the beginning each of these is going to be part of this humongous collection that I'm going to create?
I did. I knew.
Well, I said different things. So which
one? No. I meant from the beginning. Well, you put an or in there so you can say yes. It's either or. No, I did from pretty much the beginning. I knew I was going to write something like a choose your own adventure book about policy. Okay. And originally it was supposed to be more like one of those original choose your own adventure books where you have
a lot of... Do those things even exist? Like, do young people even know what we're talking about if we say that?
I don't know. I grew up on those things.
Okay, yeah, let me... Just on the off chance. So, folks, it was... you'd get these... And maybe it was more interesting, Tom, like back when it was a printed book because now with electronic stuff, it's easier. But like back in the day, you know, you'd get a book from the library and it'd be like, I don't know, a space adventure or something and... It is start at the beginning and you're a guy piloting a spaceship and then, oh, there's an alien ship that appears, but they're not answering communications. If you beam over, turn to page 15. If you raise your shields, turn to page 32. If you, you know, send a photon torpedo, turn to page 100. And then, you know, and it would be in it. So you couldn't, it wasn't just straight through. And so it would bounce around and therefore, and then depending on the choices you made, you either would solve it or, you know, die or something, depending on the kind of story it was. So yeah, that was the idea.
You're dead. Go back to page one.
Besides that, it was also written in the, what would that be? The second person. Text would say you are, da, 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 and then you know, it was talking to you and telling you what you are experiencing live. So that was kind of an interesting thing too, besides merely the choosing what you were doing.
Right. And this entire, all the stories are in second person. Although one of them I turned into a poem, but I think it's still a second person poem. But okay. So, yeah, so it's all about you and what you choose to do and what you experience. And so I originally started off really much more thinking this is going to be a classic choose your own adventure. There's going to be a lot of decision points as things go on. And for better or for worse, I am a real writer and a writer of stories. And as I got into it, and I'll tell you how it really works. So I kind of started on the ANCAP end of things. So one of the things, and we haven't explained this, but you end up choosing an ideology and for America to push America very hard in the direction of a chosen ideology, and you get to choose between 14 different ones. You end up choosing an ideology, and you push America very hard in that direction. And what happened was. I did some of the ANCAP ones first, and they were very short and truncated.
Because everyone died?
No.
Or they got invaded by Mexico?
Because there's a range of outcomes. So some of them were great, and some of it wasn't great. And
dysentery. Okay.
Yeah, you know, I can explain more about how things play out in this. But sure. What ended up happening was I started working on some of the ideologies I really don't agree with. And I really began thinking, okay, what would cause someone to, what would their life experience be? You know, what are their moral intuitions if you follow the Jonathan Haidt stuff? What would cause someone to really truly believe in this ideology that I think is crazy?
Right.
And as I did that, I began to think of people. And sometimes they were based on loosely on people. You know, you have to always have that disclaimer. You know, it's not based on anybody real.
Right.
But, you know, I would... I'd start writing and I'd realize, well, this is really interesting. You know, these people have lives and they're interesting people. And I really am ultimately a story writer. So they ended up becoming these sort of mini biographies of people rather than a choose your own, a choose your own thing with very short segments based totally around the policy. And that became the most interesting thing to me was where people were coming from and with their life stories and how could I flesh those out and explore where they were coming from and how they would roll with you know, big policy changes and things that happen in their lives and stuff like that. So it stopped being a classical choose your own and became really a collection of sort of mini biographies of people.
Can I make an analogy and you tell me if this, well, first let me say something. So am I getting it right that you're saying it, you decided at some point, it's not that you were going to say, oh, I want to show people that if they choose poorly and, oh, you see, if you pick, I don't know exactly what the choice, but, you know, liberal, progressive Democrat with a capital D, then we end up, the dollar crashes in 17 years. And so you don't want to go down that path. And so that's not what you were trying to do. You wanted to make it authentic and just try to be realistic about somebody who has these values. We're going to pick at that and then just try to make it a realistic thing.
Right. So I tried to not be pedantic. But now there is a worldview behind this whole book. Mm-hmm. You know, the laws of economics, as I understand them, are not suspended really at any point in the book. So, you know, there are realities, but sometimes the characters don't recognize the reality. Okay. You know, stuff is kind of, you know, the U.S. government is defaulting on its debt and there's massive inflation and things like that, but they don't necessarily connect it to their choice. Like, this is the inevitable outcome.
So the analogy I wanted to make, did you ever play Dungeons and Dragons?
Oh, yeah, a lot.
Okay, so I'm not saying this like to not be mocked or something, like, you know, in other words, people know I'm a nerd, but I actually didn't play it that much, but I had my best friend growing up did. And so occasionally when I'd go over there, you know, then I would like see how that world was. And what I just thought was amazing, like to this day, I still remember it, is I was reading through like the instruction manual or something, and it was explaining the different, what do they call them, alignments? Like if you were
the moral,
like
moral
neutral alignment. Good or, you know, true neutral and lawful good. And, you know, so there's like all those permutations. And for each one, it explained what it was and then said, this is the best alignment because so in other words, like it was really trying to sell each one of the possible permutations. Like, you know, like, why would you want to be chaotic evil? And be like, you know, this is the best alignment because you recognize, you know, no one's out there. You know, you're the one looking out for yourself. I forget what they said, but, you know, you're the one looking out for yourself. And if you don't strike first, someone else is going to strike you, you know, or whatever. I'm making that up. But it, in other words, it really was trying to explain, like, if you were going to be this character, why would you have chosen to live your life that way and adopt those principles? And it was trying to show, well, you'd be thinking of it like this. And so, of course, everybody thinks their morality is the best one. Otherwise, they would have picked somebody else's. So,
yeah, that's right. So I was trying to pass a kind of ideological Turing test. Mm-hmm. Some of the happiest things that happen when people read this book and they get back to me on it is, I mean, it's obvious, like, people that are really close to my ideology, they're going to like a lot of the conclusions, even though the conclusions are kind of subtle. They can see what's going on. They understand where I'm coming from, you know, and they're like, oh yeah, that was really good. You made me think. But one of the greatest things is people I've, you know, friends from high school and college and whatnot that have read this and said, okay, you know, I chose my ideology and it's not yours, but I feel like you gave me a fair shake. Mm-hmm. I feel like you gave it a fair shake and it was a really interesting story, you know, and you made me think. And so that's really one of the great things that has come out of this is just having conversations with people. And, you know, I'm always hoping that they'll see the light and, you know, something I say in there, they'll realize, wow, I'm going to bankrupt the whole country with my ideology. Mm-hmm. You know, if my people get their way, you know, I, at some level, I kind of hope that they do that. But more than anything else, I want to get people to think.
Right.
And you got to load in some sympathy and some empathy there, or they're going to shut you down.
Okay. So just so we understand, if at any point you think like, no, that would give away too much, you don't want to, but is it like the same? And just a disclosure, folks, obviously I haven't read the whole thing. I did read part of one of the stories so far, but that's as far as I had gotten to out of this interview.
Yeah. Part of what I'm doing is I'm pitching Bob here on why he should poke around through the book and look at some of the random outcomes and all that. So
what I'm trying to ask, and again, like you say, if it's the kind of thing where you're saying, well, no, that would give away too much. You just got to see it for yourself. But is it like, it's the same basic thing and, oh, you just keep like rerunning. Is it like that Tom Cruise movie where he keeps going back in time, keeps trying to figure out how to defeat the alien?
Groundhog Day
would be even a more obvious example. Is it like that or no? It's like a, I mean, obviously it's a different story depending on what happens because things are different in the butterfly effect, but you understand the question I'm asking?
Yeah. And I'll explain how the whole thing is laid out, but there is some repetition. And usually whatever ideology you choose, there will be kind of a range of outcomes after the first decade. Why don't I back up and explain like how it works?
I'll get there.
So when you start reading the first few pages of the book, you'll find out that at the age of 24, you are abducted by extraterrestrial aliens. Mm-hmm. They keep you on board a spaceship for a while. Meanwhile, an ersatz version of you is hanging out down on Earth. But when they return you to Earth, they give you you're kept on board a spacecraft for a year. But when you get back to Earth, they give you a choice of 14 different political ideologies. And whatever you choose, the aliens are going to tinker with people's minds in America so that they agree with your ideology. So that the vast majority of people, there's a few dissenters, but you know, imagine you woke up one morning and your favorite ideology out of a choice of 14 was overwhelmingly what everybody in America thought.
Okay, but it's just America. America.
And of course, they're tinkering with everybody's minds in the world because nobody else in the world thinks, whoa, this is really, like, how in the heck did this happen? I mean, every foreign commentators will be like, wow, this is pretty crazy. America has just gone and, you know, we didn't know that there were so many democratic socialists.
Right.
They've gone full tilt for this thing. And we didn't know there were so many anarcho-syndicalists, you know, like who knew? But wow, I guess, you know, it's happened. And so nobody really questions it. Mm-hmm. So whatever you choose, whichever of these 14 different political ideologies, and we can talk about what those are and why I settled on those 14. But whatever you choose, there's kind of a landing section where it describes policy-wise what happens during the first decade. After the first decade, the aliens allow human nature to reassert itself. And one of the things I believe about human nature is that people have, and I'm borrowing pretty heavily from Jonathan Haidt's idea of moral foundations theory. I think people are kind of hardwired in many cases to have different ideologies, to be attracted to different ideologies. So after the first decade, you know, first decade, you get your way. America goes pretty hardcore in your direction. Mm-hmm. After the first decade, the aliens allow people to kind of revert to normal in their thinking. Now, there'll be legacies left over from all the policies got done in that first decade. And so when you reach the end of that first decade, you get to a landing page where you have, ideally, you choose random outcomes. And for each ideology, there's about four. The actual number depends, but it's an average of about four different random outcomes. So if you think about it, you choose in about the year 2024, first decade goes by, and then the aliens give you effectively a chance to choose a random outcome, or me as the author, I give you a chance. And so ideally, you get out your 10-sided dice or, you know, find a random number between 1 and 100 and choose a number and then pick the story ending, one of four different story endings. In some cases, there's five and yada, yada. But you pick a story ending that corresponds to that number, and then you read what happens. And what it ends up doing is it at that point, it becomes more of a traditional story. It explains where you came from as a character, why you believe the ideology you did, why you chose the one you did when the aliens gave you a chance. And then it explains how the rest of your life and American policy in general goes for the next 65 years. So it goes out to the year 2100. Mm-hmm. So that's where it gets very sci-fi in places and very futurology kind of stuff. Because I'm trying to project out, you know, if America went really hardcore in the direction of ideology X mm-hmm. for 10 years, and then things went sideways after that, because really most Americans just, they're not really with that. When they kind of wake up and think about what happened, they're like, yeah, boy, I was a hardcore collectivist communist for 10 years. Mm-hmm. And then they wake up from, you know, this mental tinkering that the aliens have done, and they say, oh, why, this isn't working. This is horrible. You know, and so they end up going a different direction. But I tried to play out with some economic models in my mind, some macro models in my mind, how things would go if you completely destroyed, you know, it's no secret, I'm not a collectivist communist. Mm. You know, if you completely wreck your economy, you know, if GDP per capita drops by 40%, you know, in a few years, or 50% in a few years, you know, even if everybody kind of said, okay, this is crazy, we got to get back to the market, it's going to take a while to build back up. It's going to take, you know, that's going to set you back for a long time. And part of what I'm doing in this whole book is to try to get people to think more about the long term. Mm-hmm. You know, how compounding rates of growth work. And I try not to hit it. I try not to be too overwhelming on it. But you will, there's kind of a section near the very end of someone's life out at the year 2100 where they're sort of looking around. And if you chose a very left-wing, ideology that really stunted economic growth, you're going to be looking around and you'll notice, hey, that's weird. I thought Costa Rica was a poor country, and now they're wealthier than the United States. Well, that's weird, mm-hmm. you know. And some people very consciously, some people just kind of, depending on how left-wing they are and how set in that ideology they are, they sort of ignore it. Or sometimes a lot of people will, because I don't really believe people over a certain age really change their ideologies much. Mm-hmm. So I wrote it with that in mind. And so people will say, yeah, you know, it is kind of, you know, in some ways, I guess it's too bad that Costa Rica is now wealthier than we are. But I really believe that we had to fix the fundamental injustices of the American mm-hmm. system. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things I don't do in the book very much is have the main character, have this sudden revelation that everything you thought was wrong at the end of it. Usually people are pretty stubborn. And so to the extent that they're reflecting about how things turned out, they'll kind of hedge like that. They'll say, yeah, I guess economic growth would have been better, but, you know, I really feel like I chose the right thing based on how, you know, racist or how plutocratic American society was back when I chose. So usually what happens, I told you there's like about four random outcomes mm-hmm. For every ideology. Usually there's usually the first story outcome, if you roll a low number and choose the first story, it'll be something where your ideology remains dominant. For various reasons. Now, if you created a very authoritarian government, it may remain dominant because the government's not going to let any competition in. And then I sort of play that out. Like you get what you want, and it mostly sticks for the whole 75-year period of this alien experiment. Then I've got a story usually in there where it goes sideways, bad. Mm-hmm. You know, so let's say you choose something that you and I would probably think is a good ideology or pretty good. And things are, you know, things ought to go pretty well. But I really believe the way the world works, we don't always get what we want, mm-hmm. you know, especially politics. And so things go kind of sideways just because Americans, you set them up with a pretty good system as you chose the ideology. But that doesn't mean Americans are going to stick to it. You know, we've seen, you know, every country in the world has you know, not every country, but a lot of countries we can think of had a great golden period. I'm thinking of Argentina, you know, and that should be self-reinforcing, you know, good outcomes and economic growth lead to better outcomes, and it keeps going long term. But there are lots of countries which have started with something pretty good. I mean, you could argue that's what's happened in America.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I wasn't thinking Argentina. I was thinking us. But yeah, there was a period of founding fathers. Hey, that's, you know, not too bad, not too shabby. And we didn't.
And we didn't stick with it. Over, you know, you give Americans 75 years and they could take a good system and decide to abandon it.
Abe Lincoln says, hold my beer. And comes.
Yeah. Yeah. And definitely Wilson, FDR, and, you know, so that's a situation. It goes sideways bad. And then there's sideways good. People, you know, the realities of the market and international competition and all this stuff wakes people up. It wakes policymakers up and the voting electorate, and they decide to go in a better direction. And then usually for every single ideology, there is a very small chance, 2% usually, of a random disaster that just befalls humanity or happens to hit America especially bad or something. And it's not caused by your ideological choice. It's not because you chose this ideology that we ended up with this disaster. Mm-hmm. I just, looking back at history, every few centuries, we get something like the Black Plague, you know? And if you go further out, you know, the meteors occasionally hit this planet. Mm-hmm. And just a lot of, we get crazy solar flares every once in a while. And maybe we didn't notice them before the, say, the Carrington event, but you get big solar flares and it wipes out. You know, wipes out the grid. And there's just, anyway, so most of the ideologies I end up throwing in there are curveball. And I think the reason I ended up doing that is and it's not always the same percentage chance. I think if you choose a good ideology, the chances that things are going to go very well or that things are going to go sideways decent or sideways good are better. If you choose what you and I would agree is really not a good ideology, especially on economics or anything else. And that the percentages that things are going to go bad or stay bad, those are larger percentages. But in any case, I do have a random disaster in there. And I'm not necessarily a probabilistic person. In my worldview, I dabble with Calvinism and, you know, predestination and all that stuff. But just, you know, me knowing nothing, looking at the future, I'm trying to game out these probabilities. And I do think that there's always some small percentage chance that something big and crazy happens. And it's not because of the ideology we choose.
Folks, let's take a break from the action to talk about today's sponsor, Monetary Metals. Now, we all know the dollar is losing value because of inflation. And we all know that owning gold protects your wealth from eroding away. But one of the biggest objections to owning gold is that it just sits there. There's no yield. It doesn't pay you any interest or dividends. In fact, you have to pay fees to store and insure it. But what if you could actually earn interest on gold? That's exactly what Monetary Metals offers. With Monetary Metals, you can earn between 2% to 5% on your gold and silver every year. And if you're an accredited investor, you're eligible to earn even higher yields. But how does it work? How are they able to pay interest on gold? Monetary Metals connects you and your ounces with companies that need physical gold inventory for their business, such as jewelers, mints, refineries, bullion dealers, and more. The businesses need gold, and Monetary Metals lets you rent your gold to these qualified businesses. A jeweler, for example, obtains the raw gold at the start and promises a markup in physical gold. Then, no matter what happens to the spot price of gold, the jeweler's built-in margin from transforming raw gold into earrings, rings, etc., kicks in and allows him to meet his obligation after the final sale. The jeweler benefits, and you get to put your gold to work for a regular monthly income in gold. It's a win-win. Now, when I say interest on gold paid in gold, I mean it. It's actually paid in ounces of gold. For example, let's say you start out with 100 ounces and the interest rate's 3% annual. That means you will be earning 3 additional ounces of gold every year, regardless of what the spot price of gold does during the year. Watch your total gold ounces grow every month and leverage the power of compound interest, but in ounces of physical gold and silver. So let's recap. Why earn interest in dollars, which are constantly losing value, when you can earn interest in gold? Go to www.monetary-metals.com/Murphy to learn more or to get started opening an account. And in case you're wondering, I've opened an account with them myself, and my goal is now growing more gold at Monetary Metals. Go to monetary-metals.com/Murphy to get started growing your gold too. All right, let's get back to the show. Again, feel free to say you don't want to give away anything. Is there ever anything where, because of some freak event, it actually was good in retrospect that they had a poor, like I'm thinking, for example, an EMP event that knocks out electronics, if it was an ideology that retarded your economic development so that the society wasn't as dependent on computers, actually maybe that would be a good thing. Like the ex ante, what they were doing was stupid. But you know what? In retrospect, it's actually good that we didn't build a bunch of computers and blah, blah, blah. Is there anything like that? Or is
actually, the last story that I wrote, I just, my pace has slowed down since I've had this day job for the last year and a half working at the library. But so I'm cranking stuff out a lot more slowly. But, you know, and I was listening a lot to your podcast and Russ Roberts and a lot of people who were concerned about artificial intelligence getting out of hand. Mm-hmm. And so I decided, and I did not have a, by the time I published the book, I actually did not have a small chance of a random disaster. I didn't have any random disaster scenario for paleo-libertarianism. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it was kind of gnawing at me that I didn't have one. So I wrote one over the past year, and that's now posted on my website. And I think you took a glance at that. And
yes, the womb.
Yeah, whom. Yeah, whom. which is some Whipped of the techie cream. People call that. Mm-hmm. That's when AI destroys everything. Uh-huh. And just the way the story works, it kind of starts in Antarctica. The person's a researcher. They escape to, well, I'm giving away stuff, but they end up in Argentina. And it actually turns out that Argentina's relative level of protectionism, especially mm-hmm. in agriculture, turns out to be kind of a good thing because the seed varieties that they have in their agriculture are kind of these legacy older okay, ones yeah. that are not as good. Mm-hmm. They're not as productive as if they had really gotten fully modern and fully international. But the character kind of speculates, wow. And the character is a paleo-libertarian. So the character mm-hmm. didn't think that Argentina had these good policies. But on the other hand, and then there's various technological things that when the AIs shut down everything, yeah. it actually turns out a little bit easier to get things going in a relatively backward place like Argentina. So right. yeah, so I okay. I do have some of those some of those scenarios.
Along those same lines, when Game of Thrones was really big, I never watched a single episode, and I said, in case they're broadcasting mind control through this way, it's not getting me.
My greatest disappointment was that they made that thing hardcore rated R, and you know, if they had just backed off a mm-hmm. little bit on the violence and a little bit on the sexual stuff, you know, it could have been something we could have watched with the kids, you know? Anyway,
I heard, but I'm not being facetious. I literally never watched a single episode of, so I heard people talk about what you're talking about, but I can't be like, oh yeah, I know. I really don't know.
So. Oh, that's funny. Yeah. I have a paranoid streak, but I don't know. I haven't latched on to that particular.
To be
one.
Clear, the real reason I just never got into it, and then once it became a thing and everyone was talking about, then on principle, I said, "Well, I'm not watching it now, just because everyone's telling me that I should." But anyway, go ahead.
Not that you felt that you were being force fed,
right?
That's, some brainwashing.
So my joke was that, oh well, this okay. way I'm just hedging, in, you know, in case.
I was going to say I've got a little bit of a paranoid streak. You know, I'm an Arizona gunny from childhood, you know, so, but so, well, that's pretty heavy, but you know, and usually, you'll see in the, if you really read a lot of these, I'm really not into conspiracy theories. And I generally kind of an Occam's razor thing, you know, it just seems to me too implausible. But again, like the whole 95% thing, I decided to hedge in a couple stories, and it turns out that the conspiracy really is happening. Yeah. That there really are you know, people sitting in Davos plotting to create a world government, even though I really, for the most part, don't buy that.
I mean, they have a conference with all the government leaders from around the world coming where they talk about principles for efficient government and such, but...
Yeah, I'm sure they dream about it.
No, I mean, I'm just...
Yeah, yeah. Oh, they absolutely do, and there's always been a world...
Yeah,
there's always been a world federalist society.
I'm saying the title of the event is not, here's how 16 men will take over planet Earth, but... Right. It's the world leaders go there to be trained in terms of homogenizing policy, and this is how you do this, and look at this model. And anyway, I'm just saying the line between like, oh, they're just trying to promote better, more effective government, and they're trying to have their people take over the world.
Klaus openly bragging that
his cabinet members have penetrated governments around the world, or his graduates have penetrated cabinets around the world. He used the verb penetrate, and it wasn't a translation. So,
absolutely. And if you think about any policy network, I have a whole story about this called the Davos Pipeline. Mm-hmm. And if you think about any, I call it a pipeline. If you think about an ideological group, the Koch brothers or Soros's people or the people in Davos, they definitely are trying to get something done. And they're trying to use every lever they can. So if that's a conspiracy, well, then maybe I am a conspiracy theorist.
Yeah, right. I mean, we could say, it's not a conspiracy because they're out in the open about it. Okay, so is it maybe a good spot for you to explain how did you pick the 14 ideology? Is ideology the right word?
Yeah, I use the word ideology.
Okay.
And we have some conservative friends, I'm sure you have some, that they believe that they're not ideological.
I do have some. And I used to think they were just playing word games, and now I'm more sympathetic to that perspective. So if you're, go ahead, are you going to say that everyone has an ideology?
Yeah, I was basically, the way I define it, it's a semi-coherent worldview where stuff puts together and you can often predict where they're going to come from when they have to sit down and make policy choices, even though they can say, oh, I'm really just, I'm going to be an Okeshadian, great legislator. And, I'm just going to really look at everything fresh every time. But I really think that most people, I don't think there's a lot of people who are truly unideological. Most people have some set of ideas. And when you start presenting policy choices, they often go pretty predictably in the direction of an ideology. Now, the question is, did I choose the right set? Are these 14 really would social science back them up? And I'd say maybe not. So, I've got two hardcore, really hardcore left ideologies, collectivist communism and anarcho-syndicalism. Mm-hmm. I've got two flavors of anarchism. So, I guess I mentioned the anarcho-syndicalists. I've also got market anarchism, and those are the mm-hmm. ANCAPs. I've got two flavors of libertarian, the paleos, and what I call libertarian centralists. And we can drill down on some of these. Among conservatives, I've got paleos, neos, and nationalist conservatives. Under kind of the democratic left, I've got left liberals. It's hard to remember all these. Progressives, democratic socialists, and... Yeah, those are the democratic left. Let's see what else I got in there. I've got an animal called authoritarian mercantilism. Like if you mm-hmm. really think China is really on the right path and the way they run their society and their economy is the right thing, they're not collectivist. I think I probably heard you say this. They're not collectivist communists anymore. I believe they're authoritarian mercantilists. So I threw that in as an option. Mm-hmm. I've got some nationalist fascists in there. There's a big overlap between them and the authoritarian mercantilists, except mm-hmm. the authoritarian mercantilists generally don't have a racial ideology, that goes along with it. So, the nationalists, I tried to throw in some ethno-nationalists in that bag. And then I have centrists. So if you want to just let America glide the way it is, mm-hmm. you choose contemporary centrism. And of course, it's not because Americans are all in the middle. You know, obviously, they're out there fighting. But what contemporary centrism recognizes is, okay, you've got a lot of people over here on the right, and you've got a lot of people over here on the left, and they're doing a tug of war, but it mostly kind of stays in the middle. And of course, contemporary centralism, centrism is not what it is, you know, what it is today would not be what it was in, say, 1925. You know, when Calvin Coolidge was president, if you pulled a centrist out of, you know, out of the middle of America somewhere, what they would believe in policy-wise would be quite a bit different. You know, the country has shifted along, arguably in a very statist direction for the last 100 years. But contemporary centrism as a philosophy is the idea, okay, you know, I haven't got it all figured out, and I think it's good that the right and the left have this little tug of war, and, you know, the founders set up a pretty decent system, and so, you know, it'll swing one way for a while, and it'll swing back, and and I'm good with that.
So when you did the, were you trying to, like, cover every possible permutation of ideology space, or was it more, you were trying to think, for most readers, do I want just something that's going to, someone's going to find a box they fit into?
I didn't want to get too finely fragmented. One of the things that one of the things that I'm doing in this book is I'm trying to challenge the current, I was going to say stupid, but the current general feeling of, like, oh, it's left versus right. We've got a red team, we got a blue team, and those are my only options. And so I'm really trying to challenge that by saying, hey, no, people, you know, when you drill down, they really have different things. You could say, oh, this guy on the left, you know, but you know, what does it actually mean? People vaguely on the left could mean a lot of things, you know, right. And when it gets to hating the other side, I think it makes a big difference. If the person on the left that you're dealing with is truly a collectivist communist, that's a different problem than if, you know, if everybody on the left were true collectivist communists, that's a different problem. I'm going to pick up a gun and fight, you know. If it's mostly left liberals, you know, of the AC, what the ACL used to be, and you know, the Lawrence Tribes of the world and the Larry Summers of the world and people like that, if that's who is dominant on the left, that's a different problem. And I would say a much easier problem to deal with, because you can talk to those guys and you can say, hey, you know, let's try to have some more. What do you think? Wouldn't the market work better here? And they might say, yeah, they might at least think about it. So that's one of the things I'm trying to do, is split up the polarization. Now, it's totally arbitrary where I've gone. I wouldn't say, you know, this is my life's thesis that there's only these 14, they're the only ones that count. I've thought about opening up an authoritarian capitalist option. If you think Singapore is really doing a great job and is the ideal society, or Pinochet's Chile.
Yeah, I was going to say that's another one that people point at. That,
So there are some pretty important things that are, I think they're pretty important examples that I really didn't cover in this. I'd probably just for, what would I call them? I'd call them a kind of neoconservative that didn't, you know, it, when you got a small country like Chile or Singapore, they haven't, you know, they're free market, but they haven't really gotten to a position where they've got troops all over the world and, you know, they kind of stick right within their borders. And so I think a neocon who doesn't feel an obligation, or there is no ability in your country to project power around the world, I think those guys kind of fall into a neoconservative category.
Okay, yeah, interesting. Okay, so what are you hoping that this will accomplish?
You know,
besides massive sales,
yeah, and, 500 yeah. million sales, and yeah,
you can buy a castle.
Yeah, I think, and I'd sent you an email about this, about, you know, what am I trying to accomplish? One, I'd like to depolarize if I can. I'd like people to read this and go, oh wow, the people I thought were all, you know, on the other side, and I hated them just because they're the other side, they're actually a lot more interesting than I thought they were. And that's another thing is humanizing. So I'm trying to present most of these characters very sympathetically, trying to get into their heads and understand and explain to other people why they would choose what they would choose. And it's not because they're stupid and not because they're evil. There are quite a few characters in the book that are neutral. They pick something because they're like, I don't know, why are the aliens, you know, why can't they give us rocket packs or something like that? You know, like, why are they doing an experiment? This is silly, you know? And well, I guess my parents are, they told me that they're anarcho-syndicalists. You know, well, I'll choose that. You know, they aren't necessarily ideologically committed. So there are a few characters in there that really aren't. Or they choose for, frankly, pretty flippant reasons. You know, I've a couple of the characters choose nationalist conservatism, not because they've read Orrin Cass and they, you know, they're all, you know, they're all over this stuff and they're really committed. They choose it because they don't like the leftists. And they feel like the sort of Trumpian nationalist conservatism is the strongest bulwark against that sort of thing. So anyway, I'm trying to humanize people who hold these different ideologies. I'm trying to get people to think longer term about what policy choices can end up doing. And you've probably talked about this jillions of times, but if you have compounded real economic growth of 2% a year, you end up with a very, very different future over many decades than you do if it's only 1%, or as I fear, quite a bit less than 1%. You know, if you go back to the year 1800, the United States and Mexico were pretty close. You roll that forward, America's growing at about 2% real GDP growth per year. Mexico's growing at about 1%. And by 1950, you've got a Bracero program, because people in Mexico are really poor compared to those in the United States. So that's one of the things I want people to do is, and I do have little charts near the end of every story, which show where real per capita GDP growth went in the United States and oftentimes compared with other countries. So I was tempted to put a lot more charts and things in there. So I've definitely got a free market economic model in the background of the whole worldview. So long-term thinking is a big one. I want people to expect the unexpected. Just because we've gone along for a long time with, well, actually, as I was writing this, it was before the big inflation happened recently. You know, but people kind of go along and they're like, well, maybe these MMT people are right. And you know, maybe we're not going to, although the MMT people, right, they always have a little footnote like, hey, if inflation gets way out of control, then we've overdone it. You know, I think they admit that. But anyway, you know, you go for a long period with these ridiculously low interest rates and inflation seems to be fine. And, you know, the only people can't see what the problem is. So I want people to think a little bit more about expecting the unexpected. And I guess the last major thing I'm trying to do is to get people to think about political decentralization. I'm pretty paleo about things, and when I'm not full ANCAP. I really think that's, I just have a general sense, and this is me, that this country is just way too big for a national democracy. And I think, and you can already see it kind of fraying at the edges, and states doing various kinds of nullification. And I think that trend is probably going to accelerate in the coming decades.
Okay. So. Yeah. I mean, that's just to say it officially. I've said it a few times, of course, when I talk about secession per se, but yeah, I can't even imagine getting back into the mindset of like, let's try to send the right people to Washington and hey, who do I support? Like, and I don't mean to be like a fatalist or something, but to me that just, it is so far gone that's not going to fix things anytime soon. And so are you more like just local, like nullification, things like that? Or do you either endorse or at least just foresee outright secession?
I think depending on how things work and how hard people at the center in Washington, D.C., how hard they try to cram stuff down people's throats out in states and cultures that don't have common principles and values, I can see low-scale civil war happening.
It was maybe a good way to segue. I haven't talked about it, but I mean, the stuff they're doing with Trump, I think they're testing the water to see if we just flat out said he wasn't allowed to run, what would happen? And I think with all these, like, you know, these legal issues he's having and something, they're kind of just checking in to see what would happen. What would happen? Because it's, I think they don't want him to be the next president.
Yeah, I feel like right now, so far, we've had a fairly resilient democracy. You know, Trump announces that the election was stolen. And yeah, yes, there was that January 6th thing, the riot, and that's a mess and yada, yada. But, you know, full disclaimers and all that, and it's bad stuff. But, you know, I think the system has kind of kept on rolling. I just wonder, I just think that at some point, some of the values out there are so far apart from each other that at some point people are going to say, you know what, we're drawing the line. We're going to do our own thing in California. We're just not going to do, you know, we're tired of the U.S. Supreme Court telling us what we can and can't do. And of course, right-wing states, I think, are going to be increasingly doing stuff like that. And it can be, you know, secession can be the Czechs and the Slovaks, and it can be very peaceful, and everybody lives happily ever after. Nobody lives happily ever after, by the way. That's one of the big punchlines to, you know, to every single story is that, you know, you never get exactly what you want. But, you know, things can go very peacefully, and then things can get very messy.
But sometimes you get the anarcho-syndicalism that you need.
Yeah. And that's always a funny thing. I just, I read a lot about the Spanish Civil War growing up as a kid. And I, in fact, I just went to Spain again. It's one of my favorite places in the world. But it's really funny, you know, back in the 1930s, there was this real, there was still this really big tug of war between people who were anarcho-syndicalists, and, you know, they wanted to really decentralize things and get politics out of it, and everybody's going to be belong to these local unions, and they'll run the factories and workplaces, and you know, and then the Stalinists, right, the hardcore centralist collectivists, and you know, so I'm obviously, just because I hate centralized power, I'm much more sympathetic to the anarcho-syndicalists. And I also, I have a scenario where it kind of works out for them, because when they really get around to having a functioning legal system after they've wrecked the government courts, they start to piece together something that looks a lot more like anarcho-capitalism, and the legal frameworks that you know, people like you and Rothbard and others have imagined.
Okay, well, interesting. So where should people go to get this?
If you go to Amazon and you type in Tom Jenny, American Futures, usually what pops up is the Kindle. So you got to go over to the bar and select books. And if you select books and then put in Tom Jenny, American Futures, you can buy the paperbacks, and the Kindle will pop up at that point. And you can also go to my website to find out a little bit more about me. And it has the links in there. And my website is lilburnliterary.com. And of course, that's named after John Lilburn, the leveler who came out of the English Civil War, one of the first sort of proto-libertarians.
Okay, and folks, just so Jenny, his last name is J-E-N-N-E-Y, and I'll put links, of course, in case you're driving or something, folks, to at bobmurphyshow.com/318, which is the number of this episode. Well, fascinating stuff, Tom. I wish you success, and let's hope we don't end up in the 2% probability in the near future.
Yeah, most stuff is manageable if you stay out of that 2%. But boy, you know, stuff happens.
It does indeed.
Over the long course of history, you get some big surprises. So
yeah, so be careful, folks, when you're rolling that 10-sided die.
Absolutely.
Okay, well, thanks. Joking aside, thanks for your time, Tom, and wish you success on the book.
Thanks. Love the show, and I'll keep listening.
Thanks. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in. See you next time.
You've just experienced another episode of The Bob Murphy Show, the podcast promoting free markets, free minds, and grateful souls. For more information and to subscribe to this podcast, visit bobmurphyshow.com.